books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today we've got another episode recorded on location in Scotland's Book Town. And it's a bit of a non-fiction special, as we have some journeys, conversations and stories after dark, and ask if the overdiagnosis epidemic is making us sick. Plus, we'll find some fiction and non-fiction books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Coming up today in a show recorded at a very noisy Wigtown Book Festival, we'll talk to Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan about her book, The Age of Diagnosis: How the Overdiagnosis Epidemic is Making Us Sick. And in a moment, we'll start the night shift with Dan Richards, as we have journeys, conversations and stories after dark in his book Overnight. Plus, as always, Lynn Livingston from RNIB Library will tell us about some brand new books. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Overnight, Journeys, Conversations and Stories After Dark is an exploration of night, the nocturnal world, insomnia, the creative potential of the dark hours, and the work that happens at night to keep the modern world moving. It's both written and the audiobook is narrated by author Dan Richards, who says there's something special about the night. For many, just the idea of it conjures thoughts of starlit skies, romance, refuge, of being tucked up in bed. For some, the night means fear, vulnerability, danger, sleeplessness. At night, things go bump. Monsters hide under beds, owls take wing and foxes prowl. For others still, nightfall signals the start of work. Overnight is a celebration of all things nocturnal, and as I said, it's narrated by the author, Dan Richards.
The idea for this book arrived while I was benighted on the side of a Swiss mountain with my father. Wonderful word, benighted, literally overtaken by darkness, and in our case, stuck. At the time, I didn't realise that the idea was a book. At the time, I was distracted by concerns for my life and the thought that somebody might have tried to be helpful and phoned a search and rescue helicopter, thus bankrupting the family. Back home in Bath, I knew my mother, Annie, would be asleep, unaware that her husband and elder son were shivering 3,600 metres up on the side of a Dent Blanche. When the clouds parted, the moon floodlit the Matterhorn and surrounding Alps pearlescent. Above them, the bright swoosh of the Milky Way whirled, while closer to home, satellites and aircraft blipped overhead. The thought that there were people up there, aircrew, passengers and astronauts on the International Space Station, looking down as I was looking up, struck me as marvellous and mysterious, and made my situation feel less desolate. Down in Zermatt, people would be asleep and dreaming, but not everyone, for some of the town's lights were moving. As the hours went by, I began to think of other sleepless nights. Small hours in London, having missed last trains home, watching maintenance workers and cleaning staff go about their nocturnal work. The emergency services, river traffic, passing Royal Mail trucks, gritters, street sweepers and bin lorries, taxis taking people home to bed.
So the book is called Overnight, and it's really about the nocturnal world, our relationship with the nocturnal world. It's divided into two halves, the book. The first is night work, so those who labour on our behalf during the dark hours. And for my purposes, I've really thought of a night as between six and six, six in the evening and six in the morning, the sort of time when the majority are either resting or asleep. And then the second half of the book is more impressionistic, and it's more about our relationship with the night in general. So in there we have stories like the Moomin stories. I go out and I meet bats who are hibernating and bats that are flying around. I'm in for a recording of a shipping forecast at the BBC and talking to young parents about, well, rather new parents about their young children and overnights with babies, really.
To stay out late, to remain awake and mobile from dusk till dawn, to walk the streets all night, as Charles Dickens did during a bout of insomnia in 1860, is to enter an unfamiliar state of being and seeing. Early on in his chronicle of those nocturnal rambles, Dickens diagnoses a key difference between nights indoors and out. The latter, houseless nights, as he dubbed them, are to be endured rather than enjoyed, and the souls for whom such nights are usual more pitied than feared. My principal object being to get through the night, the pursuit of it brought me into sympathetic relations with people who have no other object every night in the year. After the pubs and theatres shut, after the last trains and tubes stop running and the lattice gates of their stations are locked, to walk the shuttered streets of the city, any city, with nowhere to go and no place to sleep, is to encounter an interminable, inhospitable world, the real desert region of the night, and a fast track to exhaustion, angst, and melancholy. Even a handful of hours unhappily awake is enough to ruin the following day. Our bodies are finely balanced circadian timepieces, and sudden change to their physical, mental, and behavioural 24-hour cycle can wreak havoc. Humans are more attuned to light and dark than we might think, and one way to crash test that is to spend 24 hours awake, as I was that night in Switzerland, red-eyed, sleepless, slightly crazed.
Yeah, that's a thing about working in radio. There's the comforting voice in your ear while you're in bed, but that comforting voice is somebody who's at their work.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a lovely evening that I spent with Ron Brown and Tina Ritchie at Broadcasting House, and it's really interesting that something like Radio 4, an institution, after about, I think, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, there are only really two people in the building running the whole of Radio 4. And the flip side of that, the way that everything is interconnected, I spoke to people who work on nuclear submarines, and one of the fail-safes is that they will be listening occasionally, and they said to me, you know, if Radio 4 is not broadcasting out of London, we'll have a pretty good idea that something's gone wrong.
So what other industries? You mentioned bakers, but there must be thousands of industries that work overnight.
So I kind of run the gamut, or I try to include as many as possible. The book was written during the pandemic, so it was actually quite difficult to get access to large organisations. I spent some time in hospital with COVID, which was a horrible experience for me, but actually quite useful in terms of, you know, if you don't die within the first 48 hours, they let you stay for another week and you can write things down. So I was in the inside of the NHS. I travelled with some of the last Royal Mail trains that were carrying post. I was out with search and rescue helicopters and up on the NorthLink ferries that run between Aberdeen and Orkney and Shetland. I was also very fortunate to get access to Porsche Penske motor racing, and I went out to Le Mans, the 24-hour race in France, for their centenary race, which is quite an interesting one because at one side it's sport, but at the other side the constructors are road testing, literally, lots of technology that would be used in normal road cars, like hybrid technology, headlights specifically, because, you know, they're driving overnight, and safety measures, all of that sort of thing, and new fuels. As well as that, there's a chapter that deals with homeless outreach in London. So I went out with workers from St Mungo's charity. So I tried always to get this kind of cross-section. And yes, there are bakers, there are the sort of, I suppose, people that you might consider, but I spent a night, for example, down at Southampton Docks with the people in the cranes and on the trains and in the trucks, and most of our stuff comes in by sea, and it's not very well known or recognised, so actually that was a really eye-opening thing for me.
My mother worked nights as a staff nurse when she first started in the NHS, overseeing wards of sleeping patients in Bristol and later Swansea. Growing up, I was told the story of a night when, doing her ward rounds by torchlight, she'd discovered a black shape on the bandaged face of a sleeping man. Her immediate thought was that he might be bleeding, his injury or surgery requiring attention. But closer inspection revealed that the shape was a bat, its little hands inquisitively picking at the bandage. Overnight, the wards were often hushed, shadowy places, she remembers. There would have been a lamp on the desk at the nurse's station, but other than that, the ward was dark. I used a torch when I walked around to check on people. Very ill patients would have a light on low by their bed, but they were often in smaller side wards. Having assured herself that the patient was safe and okay, Annie got a towel from the linen cupboard. She didn't want to wake the patient. She didn't want to turn on the lights and rouse the whole ward, and she definitely didn't want to call a senior nurse. So she scooped the bat up in the towel and flapped it out of the window, unharmed. And no one was any the wiser. The ward slept on.
I know my dad's for years, he was a printer, and you know, the morning paper has to be printed somewhere.
Absolutely. As soon as you start unpicking the jumper of the things that are going on overnight, there is an extraordinary workforce of people. And, you know, if you were in Scandinavia and you work for a long time overnight, you do shifts for many years, you retire earlier with a higher pension, because night shifts are really treated a bit like a carcinogen, because you are pushing against your body's natural inclination. Well, the majority of people's natural inclination to go to sleep when it gets dark and rise when it gets light. But I was always so struck by the idea that a good night is no night in many people's heads. You know, you go to sleep when your head hits the pillow, you wake in the morning, and well done you, you've had a wonderful night because you've completely avoided night as a whole.
And I believe you were talking to some partially sighted people about their experience of light and dark.
I absolutely was. Yesterday I had a lovely conversation with some ladies from Scotland who live across Scotland, and it was really, really interesting to me because as I've been touring the book, audiences would ask me questions at the end of the events, and a recurrent question was about blind and partially sighted people. A gentleman down in Kent asked me, is it night for them all the time? And obviously there's a big difference between the nocturnal world and darkness, or a lack of light, or a lack of, I suppose, perception of light. But I was very interested by this, so I've been approaching blind and partially sighted charities to put me in touch with people actually affected by this. And yesterday one of the ladies is actually hypersensitive to light. And she was saying that during the day she actually has to wear dark glasses. So for her, the night is a calmer time. It's a time when she's in less pain to some degree, which is not necessarily what you would think. At least I did assume that the more darkness meant less perception. But we don't live in that binary world. And I think it's so easy to assume knowledge without asking the question. And hopefully in all my writing and all of my books, because they're quite varied, I go out and I meet people who know, and I ask them simple questions and I just let them talk, because other people's experiences are often just fascinating.
Annie's father worked for the General Post Office in Bristol. He started as a messenger boy in 1940, joined the army in 1943, and returned to the post office as a postman higher grade in 1947. He went on to become a long-serving member of the Bristol to Plymouth Travelling Post Office, or TPO, working on the trains from 1949 until the service closed in 1972. Throughout her childhood, Annie remembers him leaving early to travel down to Plymouth, returning late in the evening. TPOs across the UK sorted, collected and dropped off letters en route. The trains have held a nostalgic place in the national psyche ever since the 1936 film Night Mail hymned the nocturnal service with music by Benjamin Britten and words by W.H. Auden. The narration's four-beat couplets mirroring the rhythm of the steam locomotives of the day.
Now, talking of sight loss, there is an accessible audio version of the book, which you recorded yourself. How was that?
I love recording audiobooks. It's really twofold for me. It's a good experience because I work in broadcast as well. Some of the Overnight book was originally a Radio 4 series. And I just think the possibilities of sound, the way that field recordings can be used to build this audio world, is wonderful. And growing up, I had audiobooks. I had Alan Bennett reading The House at Pooh Corner and Alice in Wonderland and The Wind in the Willows. And I think that's where my love of this really began. But also, it's really very useful for an author to read their work aloud throughout. You learn a lot about the things that you've missed out, the things that you've made mistakes on, the things that you can't pronounce. So it's really actually very useful for an author. But yes, hopefully people are coming to my work on the page, but also to have the voice in their ear. I think I love the idea of that, because not all readers are, you know, read in the traditional sense. And I love audiobooks, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to be allowed to record my own.
Tim, my father, the one beside me on the Dent Blanche, the man who'd climbed it 30 years before but clearly retained no useful information about the mountain from that time, also has night stories. The tale I love most is strange and rather moving. I remember being told it as we were hauling an old motorbike out of a barn near Bath. A Velocet MAC, since you ask. A beautiful bike, with a fishtail exhaust, mothballed on a friend's farm for many years. That day we'd come to take it home. A big bike, and heavy, turning circle of a tractor, creaky and leaky, and as we cleaned it up, he told me this. He was riding along on a filthy wet night near Wells, Somerset. This would have been in his late teens, maybe. It was raining hard and visibility was minimal. There was mist on the road. The lamp at the front had very low candle power, so he was relying on the road's painted lines. His leather jacket was heavy, saturated. His hands and his gloves were freezing cold. He longed to be home. The bike was a glade in a low cloud. Cars would pass, spray would fly, then the darkness would regather, leaving the rain and the lines on the road and the mist. He was pushing on, tired and thinking of home, when the lines on the dark road stopped. Suddenly there was nothing, and he thought, oh no, then hit a wall. And his father came to find him. Tim remembers lying in the road for a time while cars drove around him, lying smashed up on the wet road, the bike somewhere else, then people approaching, asking if he was all right. He must have told them who he was and where he lived, and they got him inside and his father came to find him. Somebody must have phoned. It's the absences in the story I find so moving. The impact and immediate aftermath are vague, but the facts are that he crashed and his dad took him home. And that's what happened on the Dent Blanche too. Although I was older than bike crash Tim, and while it was a team effort, we got through it, got each other home, sat out the night on our snowy ledge and walked off next morning. No harm was done. No Swiss search teams were called.
Overnight, Journeys, Conversations and Stories After Dark, written and read by Dan Richards, is available wherever you buy your audiobooks. And we'll hear more from Dan at the end of the show in Books of My Life.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The first Talking Books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In a moment, we'll hear from Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan about her book, The Age of Diagnosis. But not before taking a quick trip to the RNIB library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life by Eric Idle was donated by WNN from the Hachette Group.
It's October 1978, and I'm being crucified. I'm 30 feet up on a cross in Tunisia singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Beneath me, in a troglodyte courtyard, dug out another 40 feet below ground level, an Arab woman sweeps her front yard. She never looks up. We've been here for 3 days. It's the final scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian, and the song I wrote echoes across the desert to the distant hills. John Cleese has the flu. The rest of the Pythons seem fairly cheery. There are 23 of us on crosses and only 3 ladders. So between takes, if you need a pee, there's a desperate wait. I suppose if that's the only moan you have about being crucified, you are on the whole lucky. There's something a little chilling about turning up for work and finding a cross with your name on it. Oh, sure, they weren't using nails and we had bicycle seats to perch on, but it makes you think, hanging up there for 3 days in your underpants, gazing out at the desert. Perhaps everyone should be crucified for a few days because it does give you a good perspective on life, especially if you're singing a song that references your own passing. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And don't think the irony escaped me. I've always known this last little giggle at my expense lies somewhere in the future. I only hope there's a good turnout. The song was supposed to be ironic, but it ended up being iconic. I mean, you can't have much less of a future to be bright about than when being crucified. But people began to sing it in real wars and in real danger. It struck a chord somehow, and now people sing it everywhere, including football matches and funerals. Especially funerals. As of this writing, it's the number one song requested at British funerals. So here I am, up on a cross in Tunisia, singing it for the first time to Graham Chapman. How the hell did I get here?
We know him best for his unforgettable roles on Monty Python, from the Flying Circus to The Meaning of Life. Now Eric Idle reflects on the meaning of his own life in this entertaining memoir that takes us on a remarkable journey from his childhood in an austere boarding school through his successful career in comedy, television, theatre and film. Coming of age as a writer and comedian during the 60s and 70s, Eric stumbled onto the crossroads of the Cultural Revolution. He found himself rubbing shoulders with the likes of George Harrison, David Bowie and Robin Williams, all of whom became dear lifelong friends. With anecdotes sprinkled throughout involving other close friends and luminaries such as Mike Nichols, Mick Jagger, Steve Martin, Paul Simon, Lorne Michaels and many more, as well as the Pythons themselves, Eric captures a time of tremendous creative output with equal parts, hilarity and heart.
When I was young, I was taken to see D'Oyly Carte Opera Company in productions of Gilbert and Sullivan. When he died, Pop left me full recordings on ancient 78s of my two favourites, The Mikado and The Pirates of Penzance. As a teenager, I had seen performances of both at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford-upon-Avon. And now it occurred to me that Pirates would make a very good musical film. We ostensibly had a film company, so I stayed on in Tunisia after the end of shooting Brian to put the finishing touches to a Victorian screenplay, which opened at the Victoria and Albert Museum in modern-day London, where workmen stumble across a vault filled with cans of Victorian film. This turns out to be the first film ever made. I like the idea of the first ever movie being a Victorian musical, and it would all be shot like Pre-Raphaelite paintings on location in genuine Victorian settings. After the modern-day documentary opening, we cut to the gala opening in front of Queen Victoria in a crowded Royal Opera House, the boxes packed with Victorian celebrities like W.S. Gilbert and Oscar Wilde. There's a big steam-operated film projector at the back of the auditorium with a grimy stoker shoveling coal into its furnace. Sir Arthur Sullivan himself is conducting the overture, and when the curtain rises, it reveals not a stage, but a movie screen with a sailing ship at sea and pirates singing and dancing on deck. My assistant Christine Miller and I scoured Cornwall and Devon for the perfect settings. We found our pirate ship in Torbay, and I got permission from Lord St. Leven, who owned St. Michael's Mount, opposite Penzance, to film there. My aim was to open the movie on the 100th anniversary of the operetta opening on Broadway, where it first ran before London. This was to establish copyright in America, to avoid the piracy Gilbert and Sullivan had suffered from HMS Pinafore. At one point, there were 7 productions of Pinafore on Broadway, none of which paid a penny in royalties. They rehearsed The Pirates of Penzance in the UK, gave one performance in Torquay to establish copyright, and then rushed the entire cast over by boat to open on Broadway, where it was a smash hit. I believe those are the roots of musical theatre in New York.
Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, a sort of biography by Eric Idle, is read by the author and runs for 8 hours and 12 minutes.
Bless Me Father by Kevin Rowland was donated by Penguin Random House.
I stood in wonder across the road from the cinema and watched the teenagers queue up to see the new Elvis film. The boys wore tight trousers, pointed shoes and leather jackets. Their hair was greased into quips or James Dean style. The girls wore fantastic, colourful polka-dot dresses over thick hoop petticoats. They had beehive, heavily lacquered hairstyles and sexy dark eye makeup. In those days, to me, Wolverhampton was a place of magic. This was 1961. I was born in 53. Elvis sang, "You've got to follow that dream wherever that dream may lead." I bet they're having a great time in there, smoking cigarettes, looking good, kissing their beautiful girlfriends, eating sweets, watching Elvis singing, kissing, dancing and fighting. Everybody cheered when Elvis fought. And these teenagers look great, rebellious, relaxed and cool.
In this astonishing memoir, Dexy's iconic frontman takes us from the juvenile courts of his troubled teenage years to the early days of the new romantic scene in the late 70s. An unwavering passion for music and a highly tuned sense of fashion and style ignited an unstoppable drive within him, compelling him down a path that led to his huge chart successes with Dexy's Midnight Runners in the early 1980s. However, despite being celebrated as a creative genius, inner turmoil was never far away, and a series of self-sabotaging events were to follow, including a serious cocaine addiction, leaving him in the wilderness of the 1990s, bankrupt, living in a bedsit, on the dole. Always resilient in the face of adversity, after a massive upheaval, Kevin found his way back. Vividly detailed and with a truly rare degree of self-insight, this is Kevin's own deeply personal account of an extraordinary life, raw and unvarnished. A remarkable memoir, as compelling and original as you would expect from one of the great mavericks of British music.
Elvis sang about the man who can sing, regardless of what he has or hasn't got, being the king of the world. That sentiment and the way Elvis sang it made perfect sense to me. But there was a different reality at home for me. One evening, when I was about 8, we sat in the living room after dinner, tea as we called it. Dad was sitting in his armchair when my older sister, Sarah, started a conversation. "What do you think I'll be when I grow up, Dad?" "You'll be a teacher," Dad said to Sarah. She looked happy. "What about me, Dad?" asked my older brother, Pat. "You'll be a businessman," he said. Pat seemed content with that answer. I don't remember what was said to Grania, my younger sister, or Joe, my older brother, or even if they asked the question, but I know that I did. "What do you think I'll be, Dad?" He paused for a few moments, became suddenly very serious, and said, "You'll be married with a kid when you're 17. I didn't say anything. I pretended not to know what he meant, but I did know. My brother Pat had already told me how babies are made. In those days, the early 60s, when a girl got pregnant, the boy married her. Plus, Dad had a younger brother, Paddy, who'd got married at 16 under those circumstances. Was I bad? Weak? What was different about me compared to the others? There must be something wrong with me. I felt he could see right into me. Dad's outlook was the one that dominated our household. He was very strict, and he perceived stuff like Elvis lyrics to be over-sentimental. To be clear, Dad did think music and singing were things to be enjoyed, but only in their place, like on birthdays or later when we had a car and we'd go on holiday. Music was not to be confused with work. That was serious. From the youngest age, my dad told me that my interests in music and clothes were wrong. This book isn't some rock and roll story of how a kid with a disapproving father rebels, eventually finds his own tribe and becomes a pop singer. This is a story of someone who took what his dad said very seriously, believed it and internalized it so that it became his reality.
Bless Me Father, A Life Story by Kevin Rowland is read by the author and runs for 11 hours and 20 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
From autism to allergies, ADHD to long COVID, more people are being labelled with medical conditions than ever before. Dr. Susanna Sullivan was at Wigtown to discuss her book, The Age of Diagnosis: Sickness, Health, and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. The boundaries between sickness and health are being redrawn. Mental health categories are shifting and expanding all the time, radically altering what we consider to be normal. Genetic tests can now detect pathologies decades before people experience symptoms, and sometimes before they're even born. And increased health screening draws more and more people into believing they are unwell. An accurate diagnosis can bring greater understanding and, of course, improved treatment, but many diagnoses aren't as definitive as we think. And in some cases, they risk turning healthy people into patients. Drawing on the stories of real people, as well as decades of clinical practice and the latest medical research, Dr. Susanna Sullivan overturns long-held assumptions and reframes how we think about illness and health. The audio version of The Age of Diagnosis is read by the author.
Ever since I asked for permission to tell Stephanie's story, she's taken to sending me photographs of paintings she does in her spare time. Cheerful watercolours depicting flowers and birds. They arrive by email with some regularity and always make me smile. I can tell that something about having a diagnosis, or perhaps something in our shared journey together, has made Stephanie feel better, however resolutely I have failed to eradicate her seizures. And yet I still feel ambivalent about the value of the diagnosis I gave her, or any diagnosis that does not come with a cure, or at least a moderately effective treatment that will lessen symptoms. Beyond the initial moment of relief at having an explanation, what are the other implications of a diagnostic label? I have now been a doctor for over 30 years and a neurologist for 25 of those. When I write a book, it is always with my patients in mind. In recent times, I have grown particularly worried for the large number of young people referred to me with 3, 4, or 5 pre-existing diagnoses of chronic conditions, only some of which can be cured. Autism, Tourette syndrome, ADHD, migraine, fibromyalgia, polycystic ovarian syndrome, depression, eating disorders, anxiety, and many more. There are so many new diagnoses that did not exist when I was a medical student, but which are now common. Hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, and many novel genetic disorders. Where did they come from, and how did they go from 0 to 100 so rapidly?
The Age of Diagnosis is a book I wrote because I've been a doctor for 35 years, and over that time I've just become very concerned about how many people I meet, very young people with long lists of medical diagnoses that don't seem to be achieving what diagnosis is supposed to achieve, meaning they don't seem to be getting better, they're just accruing medical labels. And I really wanted to explore that, and that's what I hope I've done in The Age of Diagnosis.
I'm constantly shocked that so many people in their 20s and 30s could have accrued so many disease labels at such a young age. Older people too. Hypertension, high cholesterol, low back pain, and so on. It is becoming unusual for me to meet a patient who doesn't have a trail of prior diagnoses. They are sent to me with a new symptom and they hope I can provide another diagnosis to explain that. Medicine has many blind spots in which practices become absolutely routine without anybody noticing that they aren't solving the problems they promised to. I've been wondering for a while if the long lists of diagnoses I am seeing are part of this phenomenon. A person does not have to be a medical professional to have noticed that certain diagnoses have become suddenly common. The startling rise in people diagnosed with mental health disorders, behavioural and learning difficulties, features regularly in newspaper headlines and in our conversations. ADHD, what's behind the recent explosion in diagnoses? New Scientist, May 2023. Autism prevalence rises again, study finds. New York Times, March 2023. The story is the same for multiple categories of mental health disorder. PTSD has surged among college students. New York Times, May 2024. More than 1 in 6 adults have depression as rates rise to record levels in the US. CNN, May 2023. Depression and anxiety rates have increased by 25% in the last year. Forbes, February 2023.
There was a story in the press a wee while ago about Stephen King, the author, losing his sight. He wasn't losing his sight. He was predisposed to having a genetic condition that may never have affected him. Have you found that a lot?
Well, I think it's a really interesting question, actually, because, you know, we suddenly have this rapid genome sequencing, which means any one of us can potentially have genetic tests that will predict, you know, our risk of getting Alzheimer's and other kind of serious disorders, many of which aren't treatable. And that's something I've been exploring, because I think we have a sort of idea that if we knew about a diagnosis in advance, so that would make our lives easier to live. But I think what a lot of people don't realise is that sometimes there is something to be said for ignorance is bliss. If you don't know your future, then you can live with any kind of future. But if you learn that something, you know, difficult is going to happen to you in 10 years, it can overshadow those healthy 10 years.
And tell us about the other book that's available in the RNIB library. It's All in Your Head.
Yeah, so It's All in Your Head was my first book, and I wrote it because as a neurologist, I am trained to work with brain diseases, but a large proportion, maybe up to a third of the people I see, actually have physical symptoms that have a purely psychological cause. And they come to me thinking that they have a brain problem like epilepsy or multiple sclerosis. And as a doctor, I have to tell them that their problem is more likely psychologically driven. And that's a phenomenally difficult thing for people to hear. And I really wanted to kind of demystify that process for people and just to let the public know that these conditions are common, they're extremely real, extremely disabling, and we should talk more openly about them. And that's what I hope It's All in Your Head has achieved.
Have you ever treated anyone with the sight loss?
Yeah, actually, one of the stories in the book It's All in Your Head is actually about a lady that I saw quite early in my career who had a profound sight loss. So she'd had an accident at work and woke up the day after the accident and discovered she couldn't see anything at all. Now, it was a really confusing case for a lot of people because all of her investigations were normal. So her tests were normal, but they weren't just normal. They suggested that her sight pathways were intact. So, for example, you sit her in front of a screen with black and white squares or with flashing lights, and you could see that the signal was travelling to her brain, and yet she did not have the experience of being able to see these black and white squares. And her problem had a psychological cause, and I think that's something a lot of people will struggle. How is it possible that a person cannot see something but have the ability to see? It's quite a hard thing for people to get their heads around. But I always say to people is that these things all have common examples in life that suggest the mechanism. So it's quite common for people who are sighted to be looking for something and be staring right at it and not to see it. So we don't always see literally what is in front of us. We see our brains are creating a picture for us based on our expectations of what we think we should see sometimes. And those kind of mind tricks can sometimes go wrong and result in people having things as profound as complete loss of vision.
Have you heard of Charles Bonnet syndrome?
In the absence of sight, you replace what you should be seeing with what you believe you should be seeing. Mm. Isn't that it? Yeah. I mean, the brain, do you know what? The brain never ceases to amaze me in that it's doing a lot of things that we don't even know it's doing. And that's why when it starts going wrong, it can be a really confusing experience for us. Because I think a lot of us, we think we're in control of what's happening. We think we're in control of our senses. But actually, in some unconscious part of our brain, an awful lot of work is going on that we don't even know is happening.
Now, this question might be related, it might not be related, but you narrated the audiobook. How was that process?
I narrated my most recent book, The Age of Diagnosis, and you know what happens when you narrate your book is you're reading it and you hear it differently when you read it aloud, and that's when you realise all the things you wish you'd said slightly differently. And that's also when you find the typos that like about 10 proofreaders have failed to write to notice in the proofreading process. But it's an honour to get to read your own work, because you know writing a book is such a labour intensive thing, and it's such a kind of labour of love. It's lovely to be able to follow it right to the end.
Both of Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan's books are available in the RNIB library. The Age of Diagnosis is read by the author, while Suzanne's first book, It's All in Your Head, is narrated by Sharon Vaughan.
I qualified as a doctor in 1991. For fledgling doctors, their first great dilemma comes when they're asked to choose their speciality. Some parts of the decision are easy. You either want to operate on people or you don't. You can react quickly in an emergency or you can't. Some want to be a scientist in a laboratory. Others would prefer to spend their time with patients. Medicine has room for every type of person. It is sometimes harder to make the more refined career decisions that follow. You know that you want to be a surgeon, but which bit do you want to operate on? Are you fascinated by the heart, where a single missed beat can put life in immediate peril? Or do you want to experience the highs and lows of the fight against cancer cells? Despite all the possibilities, I knew from an early stage in my training what my decision would be. I wanted to be a neurologist. When I made that choice, I thought I knew what it meant and where it would take me. I wanted to emulate the people I had learned from, the individuals who had inspired me. I enjoyed the detective drama of the job, unravelling the mysteries of how the nervous system communicates its messages and learning all the things that can go wrong. Imagine a man who cannot move his right leg and cannot feel his left leg. Where's the lesion? What's the disease? Or a woman who is otherwise well but finds she can't write and can't identify her fingers. Ask her to say which is the index finger and she will not get it right. What part of the brain, when damaged, causes that? Neurological disease manifests in elusive and strange ways. There is a sort of epileptic seizure that is triggered by brushing your teeth. There are strange temporary paralytic disorders that strike after eating salty food. I started my first training post in neurology in 1995. Expecting to look after people who had diseases of the brain and nerves and muscles, conditions like multiple sclerosis, stroke, migraine and epilepsy. I could not have predicted how far I would find myself drawn into the care of those whose illness originated not in the body, but in the mind.
Sharon Vaughan reading from It's All In Your Head by my guest, Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. Both of Dr. O'Sullivan's books are available both commercially and in the RNIB library.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999, or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Dan Richards, author of Overnight, for the Books of His Life.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yes. Well, there are several. And with specific reference to the night, I think Funny Bones by Janet and Alan Ahlberg. There's a dark, dark street and a dark, dark stair, and in the cellar some skeletons live. Burglar Bill, another one of theirs. Burglars, we don't talk about them often enough. Hard-working people, often operating at night. And The Tiger Who Came to Tea. I really enjoyed that one as well. And it's a wonderful story that finishes in the dark hours, and Daddy comes home to carnage because of the tiger, with no water in the taps and all his beer is gone. But then he takes his child and mum to a cafe, and I was very struck by this as a child, for cups of tea and sausage and chips. A cafe that's open at night. Even as a child, I thought, I bet they live in London. You know, wish I had access to that.
So the pig skeleton, the little skeleton, and the dog skeleton left the dark, dark cellar, climbed the dark, dark staircase, and stepped out into the dark, dark street. They walked past the houses and the shops. They walked past the zoo and the police station. They went into the park. The big skeleton scratched his skull. "What should we do now?" he said.
"Let's play on the swings," said the little skeleton. "And throw a stick for the dog and frighten somebody."
"Good idea," the big skeleton said. So the big skeleton, the little skeleton, and the dog skeleton walked round the dark, dark pond, past the dark, dark tennis courts, and up to the dark, dark swings. The big skeleton and the little skeleton played on the swings. They threw a stick for the dog. Suddenly, something happened. The dog skeleton chased the stick, tripped over a park bench, and bumped into a tree. Woof! And ended up as a little pile of bones. "Look at that," the big skeleton said. "He's all come to pieces. What shall we do now?"
"Let's put him together again,"
the little skeleton said. So the big skeleton and the little skeleton put the dog skeleton together again. They sang a song while they did it. "The toe bone's connected to the foot bone.
The foot bone's connected to the leg bone.
The leg bone's connected to the hip bone.
The hip bone's connected to the backbone."
Woofo. Oof. Oh, woof. Then they got mixed up.
"Is that the toe bone?" the little skeleton said.
"Where does this one go?" said the big skeleton. When they had finished, the big skeleton said, "That dog looks a bit funny to me."
"So he does," said the little skeleton. "We've got his tail on the wrong end and his head."
"Foo!" said the dog skeleton. At last, the dog was properly put back together again. The big skeleton and the little skeleton sang another song. These bones can buck again, can run around in the park again,
can frighten people in the dark again."
The big skeleton scratched his skull. "That reminds me," he said. "We forgot to frighten somebody."
"Let's do it on the way home then," said the little skeleton.
"Good idea," the big skeleton said. So the big skeleton, the little skeleton, and the dog skeleton left the dark, dark swings, went out into the dark, dark town, and tried to frighten somebody.
That's Stephen Mangan, reading from Funny Bones, The Collection, by Janet and Alan Ahlberg. Available from RNIB Talking Books, as is The Tiger Who Came to Tea and Other Stories by Judith Kerr. Read by multiple narrators.
And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Absolutely. I mean, I love the Moomin books, and they were books that I enjoyed as a child. Now rereading them as an adult, you think, blimey, these are quite dark, these are quite complex. But there's so much to be taken away from them, particularly the later ones. The Moomin's relationship with nature speaks of Tove Jansson's relationship with the Baltic archipelago, where she spent so much of her time, and the closeness there. And in the Overnight book, I went and travelled to that landscape and sort of see how that connected.
The sky was almost black, but the snow shone a bright blue in the moonlight. The sea lay asleep under the ice, and deep down among the roots of the earth, all small beasts were sleeping and dreaming of spring. But spring was quite a bit away, because the year had only just got a little past New Year. At the point where the valley began its soft slope towards the mountains, stood a snowed-up house. It looked very lonely, and rather like a crazy drift of snow. Quite near it ran a bend of the river, coal black between ice edges. The current kept the stream open all winter, but there were no tracks leading over the bridge, and no one had touched the snowdrifts around the house. Inside, the house was warm and cosy. Heaps of peat were quietly smouldering in the central heating stove down in the cellar. The moon looked in sometimes at the drawing-room window, lighting on the white winter covers of the chairs and on the cut-glass chandelier and its white gauze bag. And in the drawing-room also, grouped around the biggest porcelain stove of the house, the Moomin family lay sleeping their long winter sleep. They always slept from November to April, because such was the custom of their forefathers, and Moomins stick to tradition. Everybody had a good meal of pine needles in their stomachs, just as their ancestors used to have, and beside their beds they had hopefully laid out everything likely to be needed in early spring. Spades, burning glasses and films, wind gauges and the like. The silence was deep and expectant. Every now and then somebody sighed and curled deeper down under the quilt. The streak of moonlight wandered from rocking chair to drawing-room table, crawled over the brass knobs of the bed-end, and shone straight in Moomintroll's face. And now something happened that had never happened before. Not since the first Moomin took to his hibernating den. Moomintroll awoke and found that he couldn't go back to sleep again. He looked at the moonlight and the ice ferns on the window. He listened to the humming of the stove in the cellar and felt more and more awake and astonished. Finally he rose and padded over to Moomin Mama's bed. He pulled at her ear very cautiously, but she didn't awake. She just curled into an uninterested ball. If not even Mother wakes up, it's no use trying the others, Moomintroll thought, and went along by himself on a round through the unfamiliar and mysterious house.
That's Hugh Dennis reading from Moominland Midwinter, one of the many Moomintroll books by Tove Jansson, available from RNIB Talking Books.
And is there a book you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend?
Yes, if I'm allowed, two books. So the first is Orbital by Samantha Harvey, and that idea of the overlook effect, the wonders of looking down as other people are looking up. My overnight book begins with being stuck on the side of a Swiss mountain, and as I looked up, I was seeing the International Space Station going over and filled with wonder about the idea that when I was stuck unhappily overnight, there were people looking down as I was looking up, and it made me feel somehow more connected with the world. And the other one is Francis Wilson's new biography of Muriel Spark, which is absolutely splendid in so many ways, brilliantly weird and very questing as a book, and you come away having learnt a great deal, mainly about how monstrously, I suppose, weird Muriel Spark was, and which is probably a profane thing to say in Scotland, but I loved it, and I love Francis Wilson's writing.
I was born on the first day of the second month of the last year of the First World War, a Friday. Spark wrote in an amusette called The First Year of My Life. Muriel Sarah Camberg, as she was then named, knew from the moment she drew breath that 1918 was the worst possible year for her autobiography to begin, because she was a transmitter, able to tune in from her cot in Edinburgh to scenes and conversations from around the globe. Every newborn, she explained, is an omniscient narrator, blessed or cursed, with an all-knowingness that in most cases, but not her own, is brainwashed out by the time we walk and talk. When she was 10 days old, Tsar Nicholas II appeared on her frequency, telling his wife that nothing would ever induce me to sign the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Age 15 days, she received news about the German spring offensive. Speeding through the wave bands, she caught the intonations of George Bernard Shaw and Joseph Conrad, the playboy of the Western world, at London's Court Theatre, Picasso's marriage to Olga Kochlova, and Virginia Woolf yawning. Aged 6 months, the Romanovs' descent to the basement of Ipatiev House was transmitted to her live. The first year of my life, written for the New Yorker in 1975, was dispatched with the light and satirical touch that Spark applied to all those subjects she took most seriously. She may not have been a full radio mast, but she clearly had superpowers. She was in no doubt about this. She was aware from the start of a definite something beyond myself, an access to knowledge that I couldn't possibly have gained through normal channels, including a sixth literary sense, possessed only by certain readers and critics.
Electric Spark, The Enigma of Muriel by Francis Wilson, is available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Sarah Vickers. Orbital by Samantha Harvey is also in the RNIB library, both in audio and in braille. That's all we've got time for on today's Read On. There's plenty more from both the Booker Shortlist and the Wigtown Book Festival to come in the next few weeks. If you can't wait that long though, every single episode of Read On, we're nearly up to number 450, is available online. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. You can email the show by writing to radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on X at @talking_books.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.